Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Anne Packer made a big splash with her debut novel, The Dive from Clausen's Pier, the story of a young woman in Wisconsin whose life and the lives of those around her are changed in one moment at the swimming hole. Packer brings a cool compassion to the most complex corners of human relationships, in love, in family, in self-understanding. She's out with a new collection this hour, On Point writer Anne Packer. You can join the conversation. Are you an Anne Packer reader? How do we really come to understand ourselves and others? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Anne Packer joins us now from Iowa City, author of two best-selling novels, The Dive from Clausen's Pier and Songs Without Words. Her new book out this month is Swim Back to Me. It's a searing collection of short stories. Anne Packer, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you with us. I say short stories, there's kind of a big, 9,900-page novella at the start of this, and then maybe a half dozen pieces in all. Have you been writing these all along, Anne? Were you writing these at the same time you were writing The Dive from Clausen's Pier?
That's right, actually. The oldest of the stories in the book is a story called Her Firstborn. And I actually began writing that story, I would say, 1997, something like that. I was on a break from working on The Dive from Clausen's Pier, which at that point I had been working on for about 5 or 6 years. And whenever I would get to the end of a draft, I would ask my writers group to read for me. And while I was waiting to get their feedback, I would start something new. And I started Her Firstborn at that point. And during the course of writing the two novels, I sort of bounced back and forth between whichever novel I was working on and one of these stories at whatever point I had brought it to the last time around. So around 2007, after Songs Without Words came out, that I began to focus purely on this book.
Does it matter that you began writing these in the 1990s? Are they timeless enough? I mean, I guess I'd say yes reading them, but how do you feel about them? Does anything, you know, age over those years as you have waited to bring them out to the reading public? Do you have to go back and buff up references? Anything about human nature that you rethink during that time?
Human nature, not so much. Technology, yes. I've resisted the impulse to sort of go back to the stories that were written earliest and give everyone a cell phone or put everyone on Facebook. The stories sort of are what they are and were written when they were written. And the time period, I think, informs the characters and the actions. And it would be a mistake, I think, to just try to add the details that would make it seem contemporary.
These are so California, Northern California, by and large. But readers of The Dive from Clausen's Pier know that was set in Wisconsin, and you knew that so well. Remind us, if you'd be good enough, and you've got so many big fans, remind us of the sort of personal geography of your life.
Sure.
What's the trail?
Anne Packer, where did she begin? I grew up in Stanford, California. I was the daughter of two Stanford faculty members, and readers who find their way to this new book, Swim Back to Me, will wonder about the setting of the first piece, the novella, Walk for Mankind, which is very, I don't know if you can call a setting autobiographical, but it does take place on the Stanford campus and in Palo Alto.
And the children of faculty and that whole setting of faculty bungalows and all the rest.
Exactly. And it's the early 70s and they're 13 or 14. And that's how old I was back then. I left California for college, worked in New York in publishing for 5 years. And then I moved to Iowa to go to the writer's workshop and got my MFA there and then spent 2 years in Madison, Wisconsin, which is how I ended up setting The Dive from Clausen's Pier there.
And then, back to Northern California.
A slow a slow way back. I spent 4 years actually in Eugene, Oregon, and Eugene is actually the setting of that oldest story in the book, Her Firstborn. And then in 95, I came back to the Bay Area where I had begun. 18 years gone. 18 years later, I returned. Very different place.
Does it? We talked about human nature over a little bit of time, a decade and a half. What about over geography? Is it different? Are they the same, you know, human dynamics, whether you're basing something in Wisconsin or Oregon or Northern California, Stanford?
I think one of the things that varies most from place to place is the ways in which we do and don't tell the truth to each other and the tones we use when we talk to each other. My observation, and it's based on not very much, honestly, but it seems to me that in the Midwest, there's a lot of kind avoidance of what it may be difficult to say or to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the stereotype of New York is, you know, everyone saying what's on their mind.
Lacerate.
Yeah, exactly. And in California, it really depends on the community in California. But I think that, and maybe it does have to do with time period. I think these days, the people who I observe most closely are trying really hard to put the truth into words. Sometimes they don't know what it is, and so they misrepresent it.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like there's a greater effort for self-knowledge and knowledge of the other.
As a California trait, is that different from New York's straight ahead, in your face, here's the truth, take it or leave it?
Well, I guess I'm playing around with whether I can answer that. And since I haven't lived in New York
for a
very long time, you know, it may be that there's a softening to human interaction in New York, or a striving for more truthful or honest relations.
And how did you come? I mean, I guess I know from having read, but share with us how you came to the title of this book, Swim Back to Me. I mean, The Dive from Clausen's Pier was a big bestseller. When I first picked up your new book, I imagined the publisher came up with it. We dive, we swim back. But it's not that simple at all. It's not even that at all.
It's not that, although I have to confess to having some qualms about having another water verb at the beginning of a title, but it felt right. The book, as I said earlier, it's a novella and five short stories.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to title the book after one of the individual pieces because it would have in some way privileged that one over the others, and so the task became, how could I find a title that would work for the whole book thematically. And in one of the stories, Molten, there's a middle-aged woman whose teenage son has been killed in an accident. And she's grieving the loss by listening compulsively to his music.
Mm-hmm. His collections of music.
Mm-hmm. Rock and roll, punk, all different kinds of music that as a suburban mom, she was unlikely to have really heard much of until she had this horrible opportunity.
He dies saving a young child. He's 18 or so, and she regrets that he did that.
Yes, exactly. And she, one of the songs, just to get back and answer that that question about the title, one of the songs that she listens to on the day that the story's events unfold is a song called Swim Back to Me. And if I had paged through the book looking for a phrase to title the entire book, I never would have stopped there and thought, this is it. Instead, it was just one of those things that pops into your head when you're not thinking about it. And that's what happened. And it felt right. I liked the way that there was sort of both darkness and light in the phrase. The person who's being addressed has swum away, but there's this possibility that he or she will swim back.
And there's a kind of please, please, please. I mean, she cannot get over this.
Yes. And for the mother, for the grieving mother, of course, there will be no swimming back. But in some way, the connection she achieves by listening to music he listened to, although it's completely inadequate, it does give her something.
Did it take you back a little bit? Get you back into the, I don't know, a time of music that you'd let go?
Well, you know, what happened is that I was teaching and I had a student make me some mixtapes. He, you know, he observed his late 30s teacher with two young children whose, you know, musical taste ran to the songs of Raffi. And I hadn't done a whole lot of keeping myself up to date. And he made some tapes for me. And it was one of those great aesthetic experiences where something just speaks to you. And that's how I started listening to the music, and the story actually followed from that.
We've got to take a short break. The great Ann Packer is with us. Swim Back to Me is the name of her new collection, a novella and five short stories. The title also comes from an actual song from the Geraldine Fibbers from their 1997 album, Butch. Here's a little bit of that.
Looking down, I see your face reflected in the waves. Touched upon by the rippling grace of a watery grave. Your hand holds up a pretty shell. I'm ringing like a fire bell. Swim back to me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with writer Ann Packer, author of The Dive from Clawson's Pier, about her new book, Swim Back to Me, about the close observation of family highs and lows. The Dive from Clawson's Pier and Songs Without Words, big early novels from Ann Packer. This time it's a collection of five short stories and a novella. Ann, in your first story or novella here, you write at one point, you have one of your characters saying, asking, how do people do it? That is, pry themselves from their pasts. And he concludes that the course of true progress is boring. How do you do it? If it takes a long time, if it's slow and gradual, how do you do it in a short story?
I think the challenge and the marvel, really, of the short story is that you have to get in and get out and figure out what represents the story that you want to tell and find ways to leave the rest out. So, for example, if you're writing dialogue, you strive to make it sound like a real conversation, but a lot less. So you need the kind of ums and oh, never minds and that kind of stuff, but you've got to be very, very sparing with it.
Tell us about the first, novella, really, and you come back to some of the characters from this novella in the last story, which kind of bookends this collection, but Walk for Mankind, we should introduce us to this story. It's setting the essential of what's going on here.
Sure. So this is a story about a 13-year-old boy living on the Stanford campus. His mother has left his father, so he's living alone with his father, who's a history professor, very intellectual, reserved person. And into this neighborhood comes a new family, the Horowitz family. Mm-hmm. And they have a daughter, Sasha, who is Richard's age. And they form a quick, intimate, thrilling friendship that is like nothing he's ever experienced before. And he's on the brink of adolescence, and it stirs up lots of feelings that he both does and doesn't want to recognize until an older man comes into the picture, a guy in his 20s who the kids meet one evening as they're collecting pledges for A Walk for Mankind, the title of the novella. And this guy is selling pot. And Sasha becomes very enamored of him. And then the rest of the novella looks at how this triangle, essentially, works.
The older dealer, the sort of bold young redhead girl, and then your protagonist trying to figure out where he fits in all this.
Exactly. And he's, you know, fortunately, he's telling the story from the vantage point of middle age. And so he can figure out as he's telling a little bit about what was happening and why he was behaving the way he was and why she was behaving the way she was. And he sort of moves back and forth between the purely adult point of view, and then he slips back into the events of those days in the early 70s and reports on it as if it were happening.
Family dynamics are so important in so many of these stories, and in this one in particular, these two sort of faculty families on the campus, but his mom has moved out to Oakland, left the family to sort of get, this is the 70s, she wants to get with the people, kind of a, I don't know, hippie exercise or something. He doesn't have that family at home. He goes to the Horowitz household, and on the surface, looks great. They're making pancakes, mom and dad there, he loves it.
Right, exactly. And then, of course, there are fault lines in every family, and the ones that are in this family are just starting to show. And Sasha, who's been a devoted kind of daughter to her parents, her somewhat eccentric father in particular, at the age of 13, 14, starts thinking, you know, wait a minute, you really bug me. And so her parents have to deal with the challenge to their idea of what a warm and wonderful family they are. Meanwhile, Richard's watching it and has his own perspective.
He bugs her not without reason. I mean, he fails to get tenure in New Haven. Now he's at Stanford. He's blowing it again, kind of narcissistic. I mean, charming, absolutely charming, but trouble there. You've got a little bit I wonder if you might read for us, Anne, from Walk for Mankind, where you've got this wonderful redhead girl, Sasha, her father, Dan Horowitz, her mother, Joni. And maybe you could share a bit of it with us.
Sure. This is just 8 or 9 pages into the novella. So this is Richard talking.
The young boy, her mate in age.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Sasha, she had a little of each parent in her. Dan's gaiety, Joni's warmth, plus something essential and not altogether pleasant that was entirely hers, like a back note of pepper in a rich chocolate dessert. It was a quality that made her, that gave her permission to insist on what she wanted. We played truth or dare a lot, and her dares invariably had me taking risks that just happened to have as their endpoints some small reward for her. A stolen candy bar, the details of an overheard and eavesdropped upon conversation. Someone has a sweetheart, Gladys, our housekeeper, said, but it wasn't that. For one thing, we hardly spoke at school, Sasha having found a niche among some other Stanford kids, while I stuck with two guys I'd met during 7th grade, Malcolm and Bob, precisely because they weren't Stanford kids and hadn't known me when my mother was around. Occasionally, Sasha would track the three of us at lunchtime and plop down next to me with her brown bag, which contained, unvaryingly, an egg salad sandwich on pumpernickel, a handful of dried apricots, and a small can of pineapple juice. More often, we'd join up once we'd gotten off the school bus, or one of us would appear at the other's front door at about 4 o'clock and say, with heavy irony, "Do you want to play?" "I've always had boys as friends," she said. "What's the big deal?" I hadn't had a girl as a friend since kindergarten, and for me it was strange and exciting. But I wanted to seem as blasé as she was. "Yeah," I said, "people are so idiotic." Gladys may have given me knowing smiles when Sasha came over, but my father hardly noticed I had a new friend. Right after my mother left, he reduced his time at the university, spending Saturdays in his study at home rather than going to campus. He was hard at work on a book about the New Deal, though, and by the time the Horowitzes arrived, he was back to his old habits, and he clung to them through that fall and winter, working, working. Sunday was his only day of rest, and we always did something together, went to a concert or played a board game, or even tried to navigate our way through some complicated baking project in service to his ferocious sweet tooth. He was 50 that year, the age I am now, but he wore 50 in the old way, with lace-up leather dress shoes and starched shirts. Sometimes when I'm out for a run or just kicking a soccer ball with my kids, I think my father, if he were still alive, would not recognize me. He would see that I was his son. He would see that I was Richard, but he wouldn't be able to make any kind of sense of me as a middle-aged man.
Different notions of what a middle-aged man would present then and in the now of Ann Packer's novella, Walk for Mankind, in her new collection of novella and short stories. It's called Swim Back to Me. He's writing, looking back from 50-something, on the youth of those years, the early 70s. I mean, this does sort of kind of parallel you writing from now 50-something, yeah. and with children, teenagers you've had, but born in quite a different time. Are they different, the children you've raised and the you name the years and those that you were in the 1970s?
Yeah, my kids were born in the early to mid-90s, mm-hmm. and you know, again, I feel like it's about technology and not about humanity. My kids are—they're like teenagers, always have been, I think, and yet they're entirely uniquely themselves. I think that probably each of my kids is as much like one or two of their friends as they are like one or two of the friends I had when I was their age.
But they're up against different things in a way. I mean, you're writing here that, you know, he's looking back on his father, who back then would have worn 50 the old way, as you see, lace up leather dress shoes, starched shirts. And now the children of your generation, my generation, you know, dealing with parents who don't act like middle-aged people, maybe, or 50-somethings, at least by the old standard. Does that matter?
Well, yeah, and actually, I think that's a great point. I think that some of what today's parenting seems to be about is an attempt to befriend the child. I see a lot of that, and I think that can be confusing for kids sometimes when they have friends and they need a parent. So I think that at least in the world I observe most closely, there's less of a sense of a division between the adult world and the child world. And it's more everyone together most of the time. I recall my parents having this very rich social life that mm-hmm. entirely excluded me and my brother. And I don't think we do that as much.
Got a question from a comment question here from a listener on Facebook. Mike says, Anne is probably my favorite story author. I'm dying to know, he writes, is she a blood relative of George Packer? Mike is kind enough to say both are extremely talented writers, and Anne's mother is a major force at Stanford. Well, you kind of answer this in the front. The book is dedicated to George.
And it is to George Packer, yes.
The New Yorker George writer, many people will know him from his terrific journalism there.
Yeah, he's living in New York now and is a staff writer at The New Yorker and very busy writer. He's also written a play about some of the reporting he did from Iraq.
Yeah, terrific, and has been a guest here. Did you all know early on that it was going to be this? Did you think you would be I don't know, scholars like your parents? I mean, what gave you the push to go out on the literary journalism beam?
Oh, well, really, it was George who was going to do it. It was always George. I didn't want to have anything to do with writing, and I didn't. George was the kind of kid who edited the school literary magazine and wrote poems and acted in abridged Shakespeare plays.
Right.
And I was just not at all interested. I saw my mother and her colleagues and friends working hard at this thing that seemed so difficult, so hard to do, so hard to succeed at. It wasn't until I was in college and a friend of mine, perhaps sensing something that I myself didn't know was there, talked me into taking a fiction writing class. And I can say I had a conversion experience about 3 weeks in. I realized, wow, this is so much fun. I can't believe this like qualifies as work.
How do you figure out your themes? There's so much loss I mean, Die from Clausen's Pier, boom, you've got it just like that. In these, there's many different varieties. A mother who loses a son, people who lose kind of the circumstances and comfort and security they thought they had, all kinds of loss.
Even loss of some unhappy ideas can
well,
can
true,
be somewhat
some liberating,
shattering.
Yes.
you have a sense of yourself as being a certain kind of vaguely pessimistic or unlucky person, and if you can be awake to it, you may discover to your discomfort that you've been wrong and that life is actually a lot more possible than you ever believed.
Nevertheless, there is that kind shedding pessimism. But an awful lot of kind of shock you, shake you up loss in here as well. Is that the story of your life? What draws you to that?
Well, I did experience a serious loss early on. My father committed suicide when I was 13. So that was, a formative event for me. And there's the death of the parent part of it, and then there's the shock part of it. And I think that the shock part of it, the part of it that turned me into someone who's kind of always watching over her shoulder for, you know, what is going to come along and, you know, change everything. I seem to, when I think about what I'm going to write, and I don't think of it in terms of coming up with themes or ideas. It generally begins with character, setting, voice, relationship, conflict, all sort of hovering ahead of me at once. And then I start to write to try to figure out, you know, who that, that figure off in the distance is and what is she so upset about, or, you know, why is that man walking by himself? And I do think very visually at this stage. And as I start to build the sentences and paragraphs, the themes, in a sense, reveal themselves, or I put them into words. And often I have to say I do think, oh, that again. Yeah, okay.
you said that you're fascinated by deception. People have also often written that you've got this kind of unsentimental compassion. You know, people do things and you don't really judge them. Do those two things go back to your father's suicide, possibly?
Oh, gosh. I think it would be tidy to to do that. I think it's much more complicated than that. I think that I try in life to figure out why people are doing what they're doing. It's a way of getting a little bit of freedom from a situation that's uncomfortable. If rather than simply feel, for example, I don't know, persecuted by someone's unkindness, if I instead sort of think, what's going on with him that prompted this behavior? And I find that, you know, really, really fascinating. And I think I use that in my work a lot as well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with writer Ann Packer, author of The Die from Clausen's Pier, about her new book, Swim Back to Me. It's a novella, 5 short stories that really get into some very complex human dynamics with her famous sort of cool compassion for the people in the midst of all that. Ann Packer joins us today from Iowa City, Iowa. We've got Alex calling from Lawrence, Massachusetts. Hi, Alex. Thanks for calling. You're on the air with Ann Packer.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ann. Wanted to validate what was just being talked about, which it could almost have been me talking, but it has to do with observing other people. And as an artist, I do a lot of that, and human behavior is of great interest to me. And I think the idea that, you know, viewing somebody compassionately and, as opposed to just viewing or being around somebody and feeling the negative of it, mm-hmm. if one starts to wonder, well, why do people do what they do? Why does this person, why is this person here? It does take away the sting. It's really important. I think with the human race, we've got to forgive a lot.
Amen to that, Alex. And it seems, reading you, that you're very much there, this kind of compassionate observation of the deepest, deepest complexities of people.
Yeah, it's something to strive for. I don't want to sound as if, I'm this
Mother
very
Teresa.
Zen person who never has any negative emotions at all about anybody. But it's a way of processing the experience. So I think bringing it to the creation of fiction is it's helpful for me to kind of bring that along with me and have my characters sort of play around in that form of personal interaction also.
But do you ever get the urge to make someone a villain? I mean, you have people who do pretty difficult things in some of these stories. Do you ever want to just paint something black and white? There's the villain. Does the condemn button ever come in view of Ann Packer?
Not really, not so much. There's the woman we were talking about earlier in the story, Moulton, who is listening to her teenage son's music collection. She does something really that a lot of people would consider really, really awful at the end of the story. And I remember when I was talking about it with the writers group I was in at that time, one of the people in the group, one person was arguing against it, saying it was too vicious. Mm-hmm. And another person said, no, she just did a small bad thing. And I thought, right, that's what I was going for.
How does a writer's group work? I mean, the way you have it there, it sounds almost like, you know, when they do the viewings of movies and they find that the audience thinks the ending is too sad, so they call Johnny Depp back and they redo the whole thing. I mean, surely that's not what writers are up to. But when he says it's too vicious, it sounds a little bit like Paramount executives saying, that won't fly.
Well, it's a debate. Mm-hmm. Usually what will happen is that the people will have gotten the story or the novel well in advance, and they will have read it closely and come up with some thoughts, some recommendations, some objections, some suggestions, and we'll kind of go around the room and everyone will say their thing. It's what happens after that I find the most valuable. They start talking to each other mm-hmm. about what they've read. And
you get to listen.
For example, and I'm listening, and neither of the two people I just quoted would have said that in his or her notes to me. You know, I don't think either of them said, you know, this is too awful or this is a small bad thing. But to hear them debating it helped me think about what it was I wanted to do. So when I leave a meeting like that, I've got, you know, pages and pages and pages of notes, and I always want to reassure people that we don't just take the notes and sort of go through and make corrections based on mm-hmm. all the ideas people have given us. That would create, you know, a extremely messy, self-contradictory piece
right,
of writing.
Right.
It's about bringing one's own ideas into focus. What I find generally the most helpful is when someone in my writer's group says, you know, this scene right here needs to go a lot further. You've got to have these people pretty much start their conversation at the point where you have them stopping it because it's not satisfying. And I'll hear them say that and think, God, mm-hmm. I knew that. In mm-hmm. some way, I knew that. I didn't want to do it. I thought it would be too hard. And that's where my revision starts.
Is a writer's group membership sort of forever? Is there a point at which you're so grand and, I don't know, competent as a writer that you just go up to the mountaintop and write? You don't need a writer's group anymore? Or is that an Iowa thing?
You know, I think the mountaintop people are the mountaintop people and the writer's group people are the writer's group people. I will always want feedback. And it's a great community. We understand each other really well because we've been together for a long time and we trust each other. And we're always trying to help the person find what they want to do and not impose some other idea on them of what they should do.
There's a great story in here called Dwell Time, and I love that phrase. As soon as I saw it, I have to say I had never heard it before, but you unfold several different kind of contexts and meanings for dwell time. What's it about?
Well, dwell time, and this is one of those, the little serendipity of the writer to hear something and tuck it away. When I first heard the expression dwell time, it had to do with coffee makers. And dwell time is the amount of time that the water is in contact with the coffee grounds. Certain coffee makers have a switch and you can adjust the dwell time. You can have longer dwell time for certain kinds of coffee or, for all I know, certain kinds of water. Mm-hmm. And I was quite charmed by that as a sort of coffee arcana. And then, quite by chance, I discovered that dwell time is also what they call a military person's leave between deployments by contract.
Time at home with the family.
Time at home with the family. It's dwell time. It's a different kind of dwelling. It's real dwelling. Mm-hmm. And I think it came into the news as a phrase during the Iraq War when soldiers were not getting their dwell time. They were being sent back for second and third deployments without the rest that they were promised in contract. So the double meaning of that phrase really really grabbed me. And when I started writing this story, it felt right for the title.
I feel that the writer's privilege there in sort of getting to dwell on such things and make those connections and really savor them. I mean, it comes in very strong here.
My whole life is dwell time, really. So.
Very strong. Let's get a call from Marion, South Carolina, and Henry. Henry, you're on the air with Ann Packer. Thanks for calling. Hello, Henry. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Hi.
Hi.
I got a degree from the University of Iowa.
Yes.
And we did research when I was an undergraduate with tracking a person's eye movements and, you know, people who were disabled. Mm-hmm. And we were recording that on a camera, and we called the dwell time the amount of time that they were looking at a key on the screen. And so it's weird that she would bring that up, and I remember the writer's workshop very well.
That is so yet another facet
another
of dwell
one.
Time. These were people with physical disabilities, Henry?
Yeah, it was disabilities, and we would control the keyboard on the screen, and instead of obviously they couldn't click the key, but the longer they looked at it, we call that the dwell time, and then we would say, okay, if you looked at that amount of time, you mean to click it, and so that's when we would put the key in or the carriage return.
Henry, that's terrific. You give us another gift, another facet on dwell time, and I love it. Dwell time turns out in the story to have a kind of shocking meaning that the woman at the heart of the story does not expect at all. It has to do with the man that she connects with and what turns out to be his dwell time. I wonder if you could read a little passage for us, Anne, about the first time she sees this guy who's going to kind of make and mess with her life in a pretty shocking way.
Yeah, it's a story about a woman who's married for the second time, mm-hmm. and they've each brought children to the marriage. And one evening he doesn't come home from work. And
not just that evening either.
Right. As the hours go by and then the days, she becomes more and more alarmed. And what I'm about to read takes place as a kind of flashback at the end of the first evening of his disappearance. Mm. The first time she ever saw him was in a 7-Eleven late on a weekday night. This was about a year after her separation. There was a guy in her way, a big guy wearing a tan windbreaker and pre-faded blue jeans that somehow accentuated his height. He was 6'4", 6'5", exceptionally tall, with a thick chest and close-trimmed snow-white hair. He was standing right where she needed to be, and she couldn't move or say, "Excuse me." She just stood there. Why this paralysis? Love at first sight, he joked when they finally compared notes, but it was fear, not love. Or fear plus its opposite, fear plus an incongruous feeling of calm. His height, his posture, his competence. He was in command. He was going to terrorize her or save her. It didn't matter what she did. This was an embarrassing reaction, piddly and womanish. And she didn't tell him about it until they'd been sleeping together for months, and there were ways in which she was in command of him. Coffee filters. They were both buying coffee filters. "Not only did I let myself run out," he said. A little later, the two of them finished paying and standing in the dark parking lot, each holding a flimsy plastic bag. "Not only did I let myself run out, I let it happen twice." He explained that in order never to wake up in the morning and discover he had no coffee filters, he habitually maintained two boxes at a time, a main one and a backup one. "My rule for myself is, when I move the backup filters into the main filter position, I'm supposed to buy a new box to take over the backup function. What am I going to do now? Add a backup for the backup?" He grinned, and she was charmed. She liked how crowded his teeth were. His hair was so short, she could see the skin above his ears. She hadn't been on a date since the separation. Just a week or two earlier, Trina, her daughter, had surprised her as she was clicking through Match.com. "Mom," Trina cried, all priggish preteen, though she was already in seventh grade. "Gross."
We can just hear that, too, over the shoulder. Ann Packer reading from her short story, Dwell Time, there in her collection, Swim Back to Me. Does all this observation of people and thinking and imagining interior lives, and I guess examining for raw material, does it make you more adept, frighteningly adept as a I don't know, a partner? Do you can you X-ray, you know, people around you, Anne, at this point?
Well, I can think of a few people who would very happily tell you that you're right about that.
and go on and on about it.
Or with great relief tell you that you're right about that.
Yes.
I don't know. I think that I have a certain I have a viewpoint that has to do with paying attention in a certain kind of way. And if I didn't have it, I might understand, you know, one or two or three tiny little things about science that I will never understand.
Right.
But that's not where my my brain power goes.
These trap doors keep opening up in your stories. I mean, do we ever really know one another? Or is it always a kind of, you know, mystery box waiting to be, for another layer to be revealed?
Well, I suppose once you know someone or think you really know someone, the challenge shifts to, can you really stand them? So I think there's always a question or two or three questions in any relationship of, you know, what are you doing? Who are you? What are you doing? Can I go with you? Can I be part of this? And I think one of the reasons that human relationships are so central to our literature is that the answers to all of these questions are changing constantly.
And what about the writer? I mean, some writers, I don't know, Mark Twain famously, become less tolerant, more irascible, you know, with about people as they forge on through their writing career. What about you, Ann Packer?
Well, I think, I hope, I wouldn't want to attribute it to any one thing in my life. I think that I've gotten more curious about people, and curiosity for me seems to step ahead of judgment or frustration. It's a little bit of a seesaw, though. You know, as I said earlier, the The moments when someone is driving you crazy can give rise to the moments when they fascinate you the most, and vice versa.
We've just got half a minute. You've written a bunch now. Why did you dedicate this one to Brother George, George Packer?
You mean, why wasn't he first?
But I don't know why. What was this one? This one in particular? Was there something about shared experience from childhood in here? Or,
More that he's always been incredibly important to me, and I dedicated one to my mother, one to my husband, one to my children, and boy, it was definitely time for George.
George's turn. Does he read it first before we do?
I think he may have read some of it before it came out.
Well, lucky George Packer to be right there in the front row with sister Ann Packer, author of The Dive from Clawson's Pier, Songs Without Words, and now her new book out this month, Swim Back to Me, a novella and five short stories. Wonderful, wonderful new work from Ann Packer. Ann, it's been a delight to have you with us from Iowa City today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. Ann Packer's Swim Back to Me there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.